Alfie. I would like to come in and read the word of God. Now look, if you are on your way to heaven, and I am on the way to hell, what is this to you?
Can't do it. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. And thing sucks.
And WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schneid is brilliant and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. It's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
History. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid. All I know is, boy, look, gosh, it's time for Gene Shepard, Lost Show from the Poetic Collection, This Day in History, September 25th, 1975, Witches and Puritans. Oh, man, we had time a minute ago.
September 25th, 1975.
Did I mention it's WBAI New York?
Top stories in the news at this hour, contract for the construction of one section of the 2nd Avenue subway has been canceled. Federal agency in San Francisco says the Patricia Hearst affidavit was false. OPEC ministers' conference on oil prices badly split over increase. This is Lester Smith reporting. Next news as it happens. Next scheduled news at 11 o'clock over WOR Radio 710, The Talk of New York. And here's Gene Shepard.
the two-two-two-two gang. Well, you'd have fallen out there. The medical officer is going to be along any minute now. I want you in your raincoats, helmet liners, and you be ready to cough. I don't want to hear no argument. Now get moving there, gang.
Hey, listen, we haven't really done anything seriously here on this little effort of ours to celebrate the bicentennial. No, we should. Yeah, we really should. And the other night I got into this little bit. I said, among other things, it hit me that there was a first for everything in this country. You know? I'd just like to know the guy that's lost in history. It has to be, well, it has to be an important moment in our country. The first guy in our country's history that wrote an angry letter to the editor. They had to be the first one. I don't know who he was. I mean, that's what the point is. I'd like to know who he was. He sat down and says, "Dear Plymouth Bugle, I sayeth now, and thee listeneth well." There had to be some guy that did this thing the first time. And these are characters that are truly historical in the sense that they were the first of a whole line, and they have disappeared. I wonder, really, in the history. Now, who, on the other hand, was the first guy, the very first guy, that bought the very first paper in America? And there had to be somebody walk over to the equivalent of the Plymouth Colony equivalent of the newsstand. You know, the Times Square newsstand where they had the cigars and all that and the pornies and everything. And he walked over there and says, here's this little guy squatting behind there wearing this pilgrim's hat. And he's got his little papers piled up. They've just come. The first edition is off the press. And they're sitting there, you know, hot and ready to go. And, it's inveighing against the devil or whatever it is they were in their paper at the time. And he walks over and says, methinks I'd like a Plymouth Inquirer. And at that point, the guy sells his first paper, and he walks away, and he was the first newspaper buyer. And one of the things about our country that is unique, that is among all the rest of the world's peoples, is that our country has a long history of constantly trying to ferret out the evil people. Oh, yes. Oh, evil. It's been believed by Americans, and this goes back to the very earliest days of America. Of course, this has to do with the Puritan ethic, really, the Puritan ethic of hell and damnation and good and evil, that there are damned people and that there are blessed people. And the damned people, of course, are evil. They're the ones that somehow the devil comes into their body and they do all this stuff. See, so from the very earliest days of our country, this was a strongly held belief, and it continues to this day. Well, yes, our country is the only country. Well, stop and think about it now. Just think. If you've been watching television or listening to the news over the years, do you know of any other country that has continual meetings of continual committees to investigate itself and excoriate the evil guys within the government constantly and continually? No, you don't hear about this in France. You don't hear about the committees are continually meeting in the lower Likers of that country. I say that we have a bound duty to root out the evil. Of course, they say this with such grave righteousness. There's no evil in Likers. None at all. He's looking for the evil. See, well, this is always part and parcel of our country's tradition, and we ought to salute that once in a while. You know, we ought to recognize what makes our country different. Our country isn't different because we got Pintos and the Mustang Twos. We got Big Macs. Our country is different because of its entire attitude towards sin and good and evil. It's what really sets our country totally apart from all the others. Now, a lot of people assume this means that we must be better people if we do that. No, not necessarily. Because you see, sin and evil are always like beauty in the eyes of the beholder. And have you noticed that all the sin seekers invariably are seeking it in other people? That's a very important point. You know, and it must be remembered. And so the Cotton Mather syndrome, which we've all been familiar with, if you remember your history, Cotton Mather, of course, was a famous sin seeker in the early days of the colonies, and he and his brother, and what was his brother's name? Cotton and, sometimes it's called Mather, other times it's called Mather, M-A-T-H-E-R. And anyway, he and his brother, they harangued, they were leading sin haranguers against the day, and they were the ones, of course, that ultimately caused one of the first committees to be organized to seek out the sin. What was the committee? Well, that was what's now known as the famous Congregation of Elders, which assembled for the Salem witch hunt to find out who was causing all this terrible stuff that was going on in the Salem community, and who had allowed the devil to get within them and was causing this to come about. See, and so they did. They decided who was doing it. They piled the rocks up on top of the poor, the evil ones, and they did. And many of them confessed. You know? Did you know that? Oh yes. And so they piled it up. And from that minute on, it was believed by the citizens of Salem that now they have done away with all the devils in the community, and it was going to be nothing but groovy times from here on in. Well, if you've been to Salem recently, you know that didn't work. I mean, so the tradition of hunting out evil is an old American tradition that goes back to the earliest days. And as a matter of fact, this is one of the reasons why the first pilgrims came to America. You know, you're familiar with that side of history, of course. They came because they believed that Europe was steeped in licentiousness. And it was, as a matter of fact. 17th century England was known as a pretty bawdy, raucous place, and everything was going on there. And they believed that they were the Puritans, and that's what the word meant. They believed in purity. They believed in cut out reading all these dirty books. Cut out writing all them dirty plays and you know, all that, and of course they were not very popular. Puritans never are. And so they finally said, the hell with all this, or excuse me, they would never say that. They would say damnation upon thy pox. And they embarked and left the shores and came over here, where they were going to form a utopian society, never have any sin. And it was going to be a society founded on totally no sin and nothing but beauty and good, and God's works would always prevail. And for about 10 minutes, that worked. Yes, did you know that they had a colony? Maybe you don't know this side of the colonies. Do you know that there was a colony shortly founded after the original colonies? It was founded by consent and by general agreement of the people in the community, that there were some guys that just, they couldn't lay off the bottle. They came over here, they tried, you know, they were making, you know, smart remarks to the local Puritan girls as they went down to get water from the well and stuff like that. So they decided, rather than to do anything drastic about these guys, at first they tried the stocks. You know, they'd stick their hands through the wooden things there, and that didn't work out so well because, well, you know, first of all, the Puritans were dignified people. And to see the assistant mayor sitting out there with his hands in the stocks and all. So then they decided that didn't work too well, although it persisted for some time, the use of the stocks. But what they did decide, though, was that we might as well start another colony where the licentious could go. You know, the people who like to hit the bottle, and which was very non-puritanical. And they did. Now, where was that colony? What state was it in, what we would call a state today, and what's the name? The town still persists, incidentally. It was founded by the licentious. What was the name of that colony? We're asking you history lessons here. So I'm always amazed at how little Americans know of their, you know, their real history. This is true history. And so this little colony was founded, and the town drunkards were sent there, Yeah, they. In fact, there was a scene where this all came to a head. There was a giant brawl broke out in one of the colonies, in the Massachusetts colony, as a matter of fact, Massachusetts Bay colony, and a brawl broke out between several licentious types and three or four Puritan ministers who wanted to stop the licentiousness. And that brought it all to a head. And they wound up by saying, well, let's clean these guys out of town and send them down there. See, it was like the equivalent of Miami Beach. Let's all send them down there. Or, you know, let's send them out to Reno. You know, let's send them all out to Las Vegas. That's it. That's the place where sin is. We'll put it out there. We'll just keep it out there. And if anybody wants it, he'll have to go there and get it and come back, but forget it when he comes back. See, just leave it out there. And so that was the sin colony. It's a little-known phase in our history, since it's not often taught in grade school, which is the only time you really study things like the Massachusetts Bay Colony. You don't study that in high school later on. You're already into the Whiskey Rebellion by the time you get into high school. So now the question is... a lot of people at that period were lost, and I have been lost to history. They were the first ones that did something. Now, you know, when the first ships arrived, when Columbus never came to the continental United States, of course, that he never saw North America, and he spent all of his time in the Caribbean, and he never got up here. What was the island that he actually discovered? There is an island that is generally credited with being the one that he discovered, and is generally given credit for the first discovery of the New World. Jamaica? No, although it isn't far from there. It's not Jamaica, it's a smaller island. But nevertheless, he discovered this island. Well, now later on, of course, as the Spanish moved up into Florida, these... Florida, what does the word mean? Florida, flora. Flora, fauna. There you go. Flowers, correct them all. The land of plentiful flowers, Florida, is what this means. And it's, of course, true, really. And so as they... are you enjoying this little history? So as they moved up, the Spaniards, of course, moved into St. Augustine... And that was the first actual, one of the very first, although there's arguments, but it was one of the first, probably the first real settlement that was established on the mainland. And as they settled and they slowly began to move up the north, see, the Spaniards never thought in terms of settling like the English. They didn't come over to settle. They came over there to exploit. They were looking for gold. And they used St. Augustine as a way stop for the ships that were bringing the gold, which they... Spaniards were taking out of Mexico and Yucatan up through the Caribbean, and they would stop occasionally in Florida to resupply the ships and that, and then they would head out across to Spain, which was almost directly due east of Florida. Well, that's why almost all of the big discoveries of treasure, you know, the sunken gold bars and all this stuff, is made down in that area, because these ships would come in an armada and they would hit the reef sometimes in big tropical, what we call today tropical depressions. And they had other words. You know, the Spaniards, they were also very God-fearing guys, and they also felt, and a lot of times, that God was persecuting them and so on. And so the ships would sink in places like, you know, Isla Morada. They would sink off Key West. And down in that area, because this is where they came. They came up around, swept up around that area, and then headed directly due east across the ocean towards Spain. Well, now, at the time that the colonies were founded up in this area here, there was a great gap of population. In other words, hundreds of miles, thousands of miles, where no one was living, until finally you hit this little tiny community down in Florida. And when they finally landed up in... Plymouth and Salem and that area, and we began to settle it. It was settled by almost all one kind of people. Of course, they went around and they got a lot of workers, you see. That's the problem. They went around and recruited before they came over. A lot of guys were in the pan and stuff, in the slam. And they got their sentences remitted if they would come and to work a certain length of time in the colony, and then they would become free men. And but those were the heavy drinkers. And they brought them right over. This is WOR New York, and we'll be back in about 18 milliseconds after a blast of commercials.
This week in the Village Voice, Pete Hamill has some tough answers for New York's crisis, like abolishing welfare and taking on the financial giants choking New York. the voice has an exclusive interview with Walter Scott, a key link in the capture of Patty Hearst, and a talk with the convict who inspired Al Pacino's new movie. And it has Jack Newfield's follow-up on the Madison Square Garden OTB ripoff, plus the best entertainment guide in town. All this in this week's Voice at your newsstand. The Voice.
The Voice. The Voice. The Voice.
It's a great new voice. Check it out.
Yes, Mr. D'Agostino, what New York needs is more Dag Bag specials, like this week's Holly Farms fresh chicken quarters at 77 cents a pound at D'Agostino's. Also, Florida seedless grapefruit, 5 for 59 cents. Frozen Buitoni cheese pizza, 14 ounces, 69 cents. And Royal Dairy cottage cheese, 16 ounces, 59 cents. No D'Agostino near you? Move. Or, if you don't move, sink.
I want a beer like no other beer.
Unshaffer people.
I want flavor that won't disappear.
Unshaffer people.
I'm Shaffer people because Shaffer does more than put out my thirst. The flavor just plain lasts, beer after beer. It's like they've been saying, it's the one beer to have when you're having more than one. It's my second Shaffer that does it. You bet I'm Shaffer people. Isn't everyone?
I want a beer like no other beer.
Unshaffer people. I want flavor that won't disappear. Unshaffer people. Shaffer beer goes straight to your thirst. Your last one tastes as good as your first. Go out and get a Shaffer and be Shaffer people of town. Go out and get a Shaffer and be Shaffer.
The F&M Shaffer Brewing Company, New York, New York.
Ben Bradley first became well acquainted with John F. Kennedy when they were Washington neighbors in 1958. They remained friends and off-the-record confidants until Kennedy's death. With JFK's knowledge, Bradley kept notes of their intimate conversations, conversations that formed the basis for a fascinating book about the human side of the presidency. Published earlier this year, Conversations with Kennedy received enormous critical attention all across the country and soon shot to the top of the bestseller lists. Writing about it in the New York Times Book Review, Barbara Hauer said, after 12 years of the legend as usual, Bradley gives a portrait of the Kennedy he saw and heard in the flesh. A president off duty. A president trying to relax. A president in search of personal contact. John F. Kennedy emerges not as the canonized personage, but better. A full, complex man with all the faults and vices seldom acknowledged in folk heroes. Get one of the year's most controversial, enlightening, and enjoyable books. Conversations with Kennedy by Benjamin C. Bradley, published by W.W. Norton, wherever books are sold.
Right, I'm back again. Do you find this interesting? Well, you know, it's funny. You don't really talk much about the early days of America. Most Americans just take it for granted. They don't even talk about it. And yet, you know, this is highly intriguing to the rest of the world. Because they didn't come. See, they all had a chance at one time. Only either the very pious came or the very adventuresome came, and there was a third group, the hopeless. In other words, the guys that were in jail for 100 years for body stealing and all kinds of wild stuff. They were in jail, but you know, they'd steal bodies and sell them to the medical school and all kinds of insane stuff. So these guys were they were given a chance to come over here and work in the various colonies. Some of them. Well, anyway, getting back to the days of the Massachusetts Bay Colony and that whole time, the investigative syndrome in American life, in other words, pointing the finger of guilt, of blame at the guilty, was already well established in American life by that time. It sprang out, of course, out of the original puritanical beliefs that there were such clean-cut things as the evil and the good, the guilty and the innocent. You know, this was, in other words, fundamentalists. So to this day, the committees
are just proliferating in our country. I mean, to investigate every conceivable thing, and this is such an old American tradition that we can only say in the 1976 that the original Puritans would have been proud of us, because we carried on the witch hunt. Now they believed in witches. So we look back on the idea of witch hunt as being some kind of a superstitious, maniacal thing. No, not at all. They believed completely that there was a guilty person and there was an innocent one. They believed completely that that the guilty were in league with the devil. And so when you searched out the guilty person, you were seeking out the devil. They also believed that the devils, of course, witches, we applied that term to them, witches were people who had sold themselves to the devil. They were saying, look, I am for the devil. So if they could search these people out, the colony would be then become pure. Now, they were only doing what later crusaders have carried to a high art. Search out the evil people. Search out the devil. Search out the guilty. And they continue to this day. I was listening. It was fascinating. I was listening to the actual recording of a committee, a senatorial committee, and they were investigating something. I don't know, the CIA or something. And you could hear these voices shaking with righteous indignation. And I'm not arguing pro or con the issues. I'm simply saying that the sound in their voice must have been very, very similar to the sound of the voice of Cotton Mather as he was querying witnesses before the witch hunting committee in Salem. Oh yes, there's no question about his rectitude, and he would say things. You know, they still have the transcript of the original discussions. Did you know that? Well, yes, that was made into a play by Arthur Miller called The Crucible, but the transcripts remain. Much of the court records remain of Cotton Mather and these people, and the sounds were the questions were very similar, for example, to the questions you hear today. I'll give you an example of it. One of the questions was that the problems of guilt in this community are evident to all people of goodwill who recognize that we have erred and that bad things have occurred. Now, I'm going to ask you, this is the witness, I'm going to ask you, were you aware at the time that you perpetrated this act that you were doing something wrong? Or did you do it from orders from a higher power? Now, hasn't that question been asked many times? The higher power in this case always being the president or the... we don't think of a higher power in terms of God telling them to do it or the devil, but it's always a higher power. And they finally... You know who was finally declared guilty at the trial of the Salem witch trials? You think it was the individuals, don't you? No. The devil was finally tried and found guilty of attempting to subvert the colony... the Salem colony. Oh, yes, the devil. And these people were only the instruments of the devil. And so, you know, it sounds quite familiar. Well, they said that he was the head man. So, would you like to hear a true story, by the way, of that, this is sometimes later, but I just picked up a story, by the way, from the American Medical Journal, and I think you find this fascinating if you're into Americana. And very little has changed when you hear this. You hear this and say, oh, yeah, you know? Because we still think the same way. Have you noticed, for example, that in our society, we have a great secret feeling of inferiority to anything the English do? Well, you don't think so. Well, have you noticed that practically all the serious shows on our public television are English? Well, that's right there, admitting something. That we do a major series called America, and we get an Englishman to do it. That means it's now really an official show.
I mean, because it's an Englishman. Somehow an Englishman, all Englishmen are considered to be greater actors, greater writers, anything you name, they're greater at it, you see. In spite of the fact their poor country is practically, you know, it's got about all the SWAT in the world today as, say, one of the suburbs of Bolivia. But, you know, we still have this, you see, but that's not a new thing. And I'm going to read a recent piece out of the American Medical Association, the journal. In fact, it's a very interesting journal, and this particular piece, because it talks about something that I've often thought about, the first time something happened. And I'm going to read it to you just the way it came. It says, the historical club at Johns Hopkins continues to be well attended and to present interesting programs. Many outside physicians interested in such subjects attend its meetings. In a sketch of John Archer, M.B., by Dr. J.M.T. Finney, the following interesting account of the circumstances, listen to this, attending the awarding of the first medical diploma ever given in America. In other words, the first doctor that was actually created in this country. All right, I'll ask you a question. Who was the first baby born in America? There what? Oh, come on, that's a famous name. The first baby born in America. In the original colony. Well, I'm just going to let you look that up. I'll give you a clue. It was a girl. Okay. Now, this was the first medical diploma, the first doctor. In June, now this is really fascinating. In June 1768, now that's a long time after the founding of the country, actually. In June 1768, at the commencement of the College of Philadelphia, afterwards known as the University of Pennsylvania, medical degrees were conferred for the first time in the New World. The first doctor. On that occasion, there were 10 candidates for degrees. Now listen, there were 10 guys that were about to get a degree. Their names were Archer, Carroll, Duffield, Potts, Elmer, these are their last names, Fullerton, Jackson, Lawrence, Tilton, and Way. At that time, 7 years before the War of Independence, the feeling among many of the colonists was still strongly in favor of the mother country, on all occasions, no matter what. Among their number, of course, were the faculty of Philadelphia College. The faculties of most universities throughout the country were anti-the revolution. Did you know that in the beginning of the American Revolution? Because most educators were pro-England, just because they loved English culture and so on. That still remains quite true in many of our schools to this day. And so the faculty, of course, was pro-English. Philadelphia College. All of these people on the faculty had received their medical education in England. Well, immediately a controversy arose as to who should receive actually the first medical diploma on this side of the ocean. You know, actually the first doctor. So there's a lot of yelling about who was going to get the first one handed to him. See, because all the others were going to get it. But who was going to get the first one ever given here? So big controversy began to break out. The faculty, animated by the feelings of pro-Britain, of course, immediately declared their intention of conferring it upon the only Englishman that was in the candidates. There was one Englishman. So he was going to get the first one. His name was Potts. P-O-T-T-S. Well, the other candidates protested in good American style. Still, the faculty would not yield. There you had the first student protest and the first faculty hassle going on right then. And they were about to give the first degree. But the other candidates, who had already passed their examination, demanded unanimously, these are the guys that were about to get a degree, with the exception of the Englishman, certificates of their having so passed, at the same time expressed their determination to repair at once to Princeton. They were going to go to Princeton instead, present their certificates to the faculty there, and ask them to give them diplomas. See, they've already got their certificates that they passed everything, and they figured, well, let's go down to Princeton, and they'll give us all these diplomas. The idea of losing 9 out of 10 members of this, their first graduating class, was a little more than the faculty could stand, so they agreed to let the young rebels arrange the matter among themselves. Whereupon, they took a vote and decided to receive their diplomas in alphabetical order.
Friends, how many times have I told you that people at the end of the alphabet never win?
This is WOR. Oh, no, no. You want a break for commercials? Okay, I'll be right back.
Here is an exciting free offer that both men and women can take advantage of. Now, during their national anniversary celebration, you can join European Health Spas for 1 week, absolutely free, no strings attached. If you're curving out where you want to curve in, flabbing where you want to flex, sagging where you want to be solid, you've got nothing to lose, except maybe some inches or pounds or both. European Health Spas have the techniques and facilities to help make you the body you can be. Exercise equipment, indoor swimming pool, sauna, steam room, and more. Plus good eating tips to help you stay in shape. So hurry up and get your body into the European Health Spa. The free membership offer ends September 30th. Check your white pages for the European Health Spa nearest you. Don't miss out on the 1 week free membership.
He's a marathon man, running for the sheer joy of it, until he becomes the prey in a terrifying chase, until he stumbles into a violent world of espionage and double agents, until the boy who dreamed of winning marathon races suddenly becomes a man running for his life. Marathon Man. Critics call it breathtaking, the best American thriller this year. William Goldman's Marathon Man. Now a Dell bestseller wherever paperbacks are sold. Don't let anyone tell you how it ends.
That was exciting. Keep them rolling with the Long Island Press. Every Thursday, the Long Island Press publishes a special do-it-yourself column of auto repairs that can save you many dollars in expensive repair bills. Learn the exciting, thrilling new hobby of valve grinding. It's really exciting. Learn how to replace new gaskets and mufflers and, you know, just get under there and get that old grease going. It's really exciting. Join the prestige group, the more than million Long Island Press readers, and keep your car rolling.
Fly Aeromexico, the airline of Mexico to Mexico soon.
Aeromexico, Aeromexico.
Aeromexico, the airline that takes you to Mexico City and on to Acapulco on El Grande, our wide-body DC-10.
Aeromexico, Aeromexico.
Aeromexico is the only airline to offer you first-run movies as well as stereophonic music on your flight down to Mexico City.
Ay, 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 ay. Ay, 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 ay.
And to make your trip even better, Aeromexico has over 1,000 Aeromexico quality-approved tours to Mexico. There's bound to be one just for you. See your travel agent or call Aeromexico, the airline of Mexico, and fly with us soon.
We're here at the Brasserie Restaurant, 100 East 53rd Street, where they're having a Champagne Harvest Festival.
Absolutely incredible, right, sir?
I love it, I love it.
Oh,
now enjoy the music and champagnes of France at the Brasserie, 100 East 53rd Street. It's the Champagne Harvest Festival, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Great French regional cookery with the largest selection of champagnes of France ever put into an American restaurant. And as inexpensive as serving it in your own home. And there's nightly entertainment, too, with the Brasserie singers, dancers, and musicians. It's an incredible Champagne Harvest Festival with champagne breakfast, lunches, dinners, and the late-night Cochelet Buffet with over 20 great dishes of the Champagne region.
I love it. I love it.
Oh, come on, Murray. Talking like that, we're not friends.
I can't help it. Every time I sip this Brasserie champagne, I get continental.
The Brasserie 24-hour-a-day Champagne Harvest Festival now through October 11th at the Brasserie, 100 East 53rd Street. Fantastic.
Well, here these poor guys are. You know, they've decided to do it in alphabetical order. And the Englishman, because his name was P. Potts, he came down a line, you know. He was about fourth in line, whereas a strictly alphabetical arrangement would have placed him eighth. You see, if they were really going to do it alphabetically, he should have been eighth. But because he was English, and because the big hassle was over whether or not Englishmen should get it first, they moved him up to fourth. Already, people were losing out because their name was at the end of the alphabet. I've always said that the last third of the alphabet has missed out on almost everything good in life. The only thing they don't seem to send out alphabetically is bills. It seems to me that they reverse the order then. And I've noticed that almost all the guys that have got the big top television shows, names begin with the first group in the Alps. Joe, look at it. Chancellor, Cronkite, Carson, Steve Allen, Merv Griffin. They're all there. Mike Douglas. There's not a Chester Wisniewski show for hell or high water. Yeah, they're all very interesting, you know, little side issue there. But this little side look into the first time that, you know, the first thing. Do you know that, speaking of the first, do you know that recently, and it was very amazingly recently, like, say, within the last 3 years, there was a kind of an interesting but somewhat sad, curious, fascinating obituary that appeared in one of the local papers. I think it was the Times. And it was a person died in up in New England someplace. And it was a person who, I believe it was a man, and he died, and the whole editorial or the whole thrust of the obituary was that he was the first person on record that anybody knows about who received the first traffic ticket ever given in America. that is a distinction. I mean, it really is. He was, and he never did anything else in his life of any particular importance, but you know, people would point him out down at the end of the bar. You know, there's Charlie down there, and you never guess, he was the first man in the country to receive the traffic ticket. Well, another guy died here recently, within the last 2 years or three, and he also had a curious distinction. He was the first man to design and install and create the whole concept of the traffic light. Nobody had ever done that before. The idea of a light that would tell you to go or to stop, that worked by itself. It was very controversial. You can't believe it at this time, but it was an extremely controversial idea because nobody believed that it would work. They'd say, well, who's going to obey a light? It's ridiculous. And he says, no, people will obey this light, and we'll put this up and install it and see what happens. And he designed the whole thing. And he himself was a very lukewarm driver, rarely drove in his entire lifetime. But he really affected drivers for all time. No matter where you go in the world now today, you go to places in Africa, you go any place in the world, you go up to Nome and they got a traffic light. They really do. And there's that little thing hanging in the middle of the street with a red light. And he's affected the entire world. And he just recently passed out. And I wonder just how he felt, you know, in the later days of his life, as he would drive down the street in the back of somebody's car and he would see thousands of cars waiting for lights. And that he did this, man. He did it. And that was a historical character. Now, there was another one, too. Again, you see these great little historical moments of people passing. Because our world is getting older and older, seeing as it does. As America grows further away from its roots, people who were involved in the earliest days of things will, of course, disappear. And we're living in the time when a few of them still remain. You can, to give you an idea, here you are, all you're listening, I don't care what your age is, you were alive at the time that the man who designed the first traffic light was still alive. So, years from now, people are going to think you must be 500 years old if you say, yeah. Well, a woman just died here recently, and being a pilot, I was particularly interested in this one. This woman died, and she was famous for another very curious thing. She was the first woman to ever fly an airplane and to be licensed, and this was what was interesting. She had one of the first 5 licenses ever issued in America. Not only was she one of the first women flyers, but she was one of the first 5 pilots to get a license, and her license was signed by Orville Wright. She had learned under Orville Wright. Orville Wright taught her to fly. Now that's going to the source. And she just passed on quietly. some town, who cared? You know, very few people probably knew that nice little old lady that came down to the shop right once in a while with a little net shopping bag was one of the first daredevils in the world. I mean, really. So, you know, these firsts like that, guys that do something like that, that forever affect the world, to me, are historical people. But they're not historical in the political sense. They're historical in, I suppose you might say, the technological sense, you know, the sense of, you know, that a man died here. Again, this was within the past 10 years. I saw his obituary. A man died who conducted one of the very first experiments, and in fact, he was generally credited to be the first person whose voice was actually ever broadcast over any electrical media. In other words, over television or radio. Can you imagine that guy? He was the first guy that talked over radio. He was an engineer, and he's lost to most people's popular history, but he was an experimenter, and he actually talked over... No, it wasn't DeForest. Oh, no. No. DeForest invented a radio, too, but he didn't think much in terms of modulation. This guy was one of the first people... In fact, he did this before DeForest had done his work. And was a fascinating character. He passed into the great beyond, but there he was, you know. And also another guy within the last 8 or 9 years died. He was the first man ever to send a message across the ocean by way of radio. He set up a station, and he talked to a guy in Scotland. They arranged it. See, the two of them made all the arrangements, and he sent an actual message from a radio station he built across the entire ocean. That was a fascinating first. What was his name? Well, I'll give you a clue. All right, I'll tell you. His name was Godley, G-O-D-L-E-Y. You would never hear of him. But if you're a ham, you would. He was considered the first amateur in the world. And these first guys that do these things, it's hard to believe that there have to be people listening to me right now who must remember seeing the first car that came to their town. That's that reason. Isn't that historically out of the question? So, you know, as we approach our bicentennial, we ought to get, I wish somebody would get together a group of really old people, like people who are 100 years old, and have them on panels like Johnny Carson and that, to talk about the earliest president they remember. Wouldn't it be fascinating to hear a guy talk who actually remembers, say, when he was a little kid, Millard Fillmore was in the White House. You know, we always think of that stuff as so remote. And yet there have to be guys around who are still mad that Teddy Roosevelt didn't get elected on the Bull Moose Party. They're still out there, still bugged by it. No, we have a short history, friends, but a very, very fascinating and spotty one. And the investigation goes on. This is WOR. We'll catch evil yet. This is WOR New York. Stay tuned for In Conversation.
No, this is WBAI New York, and stay tuned for the Jimmy Dore Show. We're way out of time. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week on Sunday night, 8 p.m., for the Golden Age of Radio. Stay tuned.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal. Well, I'm going to go clean the bathroom.